Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Carl Finkenbinder, and I represent the appellant Point Royal Property Owners Association. I'll refer to it as the POA for sake of ease. The POA is a community association located in Taney County, just outside of the city limits of Branson. Like all POAs, it has a declaration that it abides by. This declaration that is the substance of the litigation and why we're here today contains a couple of provisions or mechanisms in which the association can collect dues. One is the filing of liens on real estate, and then it can exercise certain rights with regard to those liens. A second avenue is to sue or to pursue the personal obligation of each lot or unit owner within the subdivision. That is the heart of this dispute. There is a provision within this declaration that contains and states that the personal obligation of a lot owner or a unit owner, will, when a lot is sold, that personal obligation passes to its successor in title. At the trial court, and based on that, we, after the plaintiff at the trial court and the bank, alleged that it did not owe these dues. Point Royal asserted that it did owe the dues after it foreclosed on some units, and there were still dues left owed on these lots, and that was the heart of the dispute at the trial court. The trial court ignored the declaration pretty much in its entirety and focused in on the Uniform Condominium Act of Missouri and used it to say or override or supersede what we were talking about in the declaration. On appeal, we believe that the Southern District had the right, was focusing on the right issue, but came to the wrong conclusion. Basically, what they said is the Southern District looked at that provision in the declaration and said that the word successors in title was ambiguous. And then after they said it was ambiguous, they went through an analysis of the contract to make a determination that the bank was not liable for the assessments that had accrued prior to their ownership. But I think in its decision, the Southern District makes a couple of statements that I think are telling, and I'd like to just point out those statements. First, on page 9 of its opinion, the Southern District stated that what it was not doing was it was not holding that an affirmative covenant can't be written in such a way as to obligate a subsequent purchaser for an assessment owed by a prior owner. The reason why that's significant is the Southern District acknowledged that that is permitted. There's no other constitutional issues. It's not a public, there's nothing in the public policy would prevent that from happening. And if it were worded right, the courts in Missouri would uphold such a provision. Their problem was the exact wording of the provision. But my question would be this: if that's the case, what possible wording in this case could we have possibly used to make it any more clear that that's what we were trying to do in using the word successors in title? For that reason, we spent significant time briefing that issue, and I think a couple of cases that we cited are very telling. I will acknowledge, as I did in the Southern District, this exact point has not been decided in Missouri, which is why we're here. And although the principles of law are tangibly been discussed through Missouri law, meaning there's a distinction between the personal obligation to pay and the lien obligation, or the obligation of the real estate to pay, while those issues have been litigated ad infinitum within the state of Missouri, this particular issue has not. But it has been litigated in two other cases that we cited in our brief, one in New York and one in Florida. The Florida case is called Pundlet 2 Joint Venture LLP versus Westwood Gardens. And although the facts are slightly different in that case, the point is still valid. They use the exact same language that the Court of Appeals here said was ambiguous. The court in Pundlet in Florida stated that that phrase was clear and unambiguous. They spent no time analyzing its ambiguity. They made an assumption automatically that they knew exactly what that phrase meant. There was no question about it. And then they proceeded on different issues. And to highlight the difference, I want to be honest, that case was slightly different because in the Florida legislature had actually gone so far as to pass a statute obligating successors in title to pay the personal obligation of the former owner. In that case, it was a freedom of contract issue, and the court said that the declaration could override that statute. They had the freedom of contract, and they could override it. And the declaration in that case did specifically state that the personal obligation would not pass unless expressly assumed. But it still uses the same phrase, successors entitled, and that court does say that phrase, and they do say specifically that that phrase was clear and unambiguous. The New York case is a little bit different. There's no statute there. The New York case was Port Village HOA Incorporated versus Summit Associates. And again, like the Florida case, it contained the opposite or a mirror image of this case in that the language stated that it used again the language successors entitled, but it stated that the successors entitled would not be liable unless expressly assumed. Once again, the court did not engage in any analysis to whether or not successors entitled was ambiguous. There was no question about it. And that's the point of that case. I would like to highlight one additional point of that case. I didn't think it's relevant, but I think it may be relevant, particularly based on what the Court of Appeals in this case did, in that the lien obligation, both the respondent and the Court of Appeals, we believe have inappropriately are trying to mix two completely separate legal analysis, one regarding the lien obligation and one regarding the personal obligation to pay. In the New York case, the Port Village HOA case, the lien obligation language preceded, just like in this case, there was a lien obligation language in that case that preceded the personal obligation language, and it was the exact same that our declaration contains. And that language is that the lien shall attach to the real estate in the current owner's hands and his heirs, devisees, personal representatives, and signs. That exact language is in use that in that case. And the reason why I think that's highly significant, Your Honors, is because when it looks at the declaration in this case, when it looks at the declaration in the Florida case, and when it looks at the declaration in the New York case, what we can see is that the language used here is extremely common nomenclature among lawyers, drafters, used throughout the entire United States. That this is what we say when we're talking about personal obligations to pay assessments and the real estate's obligations to pay assessments. And if the court were to affirm the trial court or the Southern District, then what's going to happen in this case is that this common nomenclature that's been used throughout the United States is going to be put into question and doubt. And then we're going to have to deal with it. And I think that's the main problem. If you look at the Court of Appeals decision, the Southern District's decision, I think they also say something else that's telling. I think that they understood that they were on shaky ground when they ruled that this was ambiguous, because they even stated on page 14 of their decision, they said, well, even if we're wrong, even if we have engaged in inappropriate analysis, we're going to use a fallback position that since it was ambiguous, we're going to construe it against the drafter. And that was their backup position. It's very rare where you see a court feel it necessary to come up with backup positions to its argument. And the reason we think that they did that is because they recognize the flawed nature of their reasoning.
Now, clearly, you don't think that the bank falls into the category of the heir, devisee, personal representative, or assigns, do you?
I actually would dispute potentially that they would be an assign. However, the reason why that was not addressed in any of my briefs is because that is not a necessary decision that this court has to reach. Obviously, what we've argued is that this court can completely ignore that provision, because to use a separately unrelated legal provision in the declaration to create an ambiguity in the personal obligation clause wouldn't make sense. And I would like to highlight that really quick, Your Honor. And I think that an appropriate analysis or analogy the Southern District didn't say this exactly. The respondent alluded to the concept, the Latin phrase, ejusdem generis, to talk about that issue. The Court of Appeals didn't use that exact phrase, but they kind of went along with the same analysis. What we have briefed, as we put in our brief, there's a helpful case, Standard Operations, Inc. versus Montauk, and this is a case before this court, in 1988. And it makes a distinction, and it talks about, it goes through what that Latin phrase means in that analysis. And it talked about how, basically it made a distinction between, it used an analogy of farm animals versus exotic animals. When you're talking about a group of farm animals, we can assume that it explicitly is excluding exotic animals. In this case, that could apply, but I would take it even one step further. In this case, when we're talking about the personal obligation to pay, we're not talking, when we're talking about the personal obligation to pay, we're not talking about farm animals at all. In that instance, we're talking about something entirely different. Maybe perhaps auto equipment. The subjects are so different.
The property owner didn't assign their interest to the bank. I mean, it was an involuntary proceeding. It was a foreclosure.
That is correct, Your Honor. I do not dispute that. I don't dispute that.
But you're saying that's really irrelevant because if successor's entitle is unambiguous and if it's broad enough to include the bank, then it doesn't matter what liens can attach to. They're saying you have to read those two phrases together, though, because they're in the contract and they both deal with the property and with the obligation to pay the fees. And if you read them together, it limits successors and titles, otherwise broad meaning. You disagree with that. Can you tell us why?
Yes, obviously I do, Your Honor, and for a couple of reasons. One, I think that, of course, the two decisions I've cited didn't have that problem at all either. But even if for some reason this court were to believe that we did have to look at that previous provision for some sort of guidance, it has no limitation on the second provision. And the concepts or the Latin phrases, the Latin concepts that the respondent uses would have no applicability here.
Yeah, I understood you to say in your brief, too, that if they wanted it to be limited to that group, the heirs and assigns, they would have used that phrase. But since they chose to use a different phrase, successors and title, they must have meant something different by it.
Clearly, we do believe. And I think that it's problematic when the respondent begins to assume that the declarant had certain things in mind. We can't begin making those assumptions when the language is clear and ambiguous from the language itself in the declaration. And I'd also like to point out that the respondent spends some significant time talking about in its brief at its end that if the court were to rule for, well, at that, my time is up.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Rick Schnocke. I represent the bank. If I had a catalog, I'd stand on it and get up above this light. I want to talk about these out-of-state cases that Point Royal has cited because I think they do not contain the exact same language, as Mr. Finkenbinder said, in the lien clause that immediately precedes the personal obligation clause. Just as an aside, all of the districts of the Court of Appeals agree, and I've cited that in a footnote in my brief, that we look to the entire language of the agreement. And Point Royal in its brief says we look to the entire language of the agreement. But yet it wants to focus on one sentence and three words in one sentence without looking at the context that we're talking about. We're talking about a lien clause that immediately precedes the next sentence, the personal obligation clause, and both of them deal with how does the association collect its money.
And why doesn't that cut against your argument rather than in favor of it? Because in one clause talking about the lien, they listed heirs, assigns, etc., and they chose to use a different word in the next sentence saying successors and title, something that's much broader than that.
Exactly,
why isn't Judge, reading it all together undercut your argument that they must have, because it gives no meaning to the change in language?
Well, I think when you look at the reason or how you interpret that, okay, there are a couple of doctrines that apply, and I speak German pretty well, but I don't speak Latin worth a hoot. So, justem generis, okay, when you use specific language and then you use a broader general term at the end, you construe the broader general term within the parameters of the specific language. There's
What different meaning are you giving to successors and title? Because they used a different phrase and only in that one place. And I read carefully what you said, but you're saying they really meant it as a shorthand reference to the earlier one, and there's nothing to indicate that. They no place else use a shorthand reference. They chose to use a different language, and I know you know that we also have many maxims that say if the legislature or if a contractor or other document chooses to use different terms, we give meaning to that choice. And I'm not clear what meaning you're giving to that choice.
The meaning I'm giving to that choice, Judge, is to limit the broad term successors in title to the parameters of the...
But tell me what it means differently. You're saying these words mean the same thing, and I don't know any...
No, I'm not saying necessarily they mean the same thing.
...maxim that says different words mean the same thing if they follow each other.
I think maybe if I...
So I want you to identify what you're
if
saying.
If I said they mean the same thing, I don't mean that. What I mean is that this broad term successors in title encompasses the more limited group, not necessarily only
these four. And what else does it mean? Tell me if it doesn't mean the exact same thing, what else does it mean? I'm trying to get identified.
Well, I have to think about what other potential owners, successor owners, might have a personal relationship with the defaulting owner. You know, a grantee in a beneficiary deed, for example, where title passes at death, that's somebody who is not necessarily an assigned because you can't assign something once you're dead.
Well, why wouldn't they have a personal obligation under successors in title then?
Well, those people will step into the shoes of the owner, Judge. They've dealt with the owner.
No, I mean, I understand they would. That's a type of successor title. But what makes the situation here, what makes them any less of a successor in title?
The bank.
Well, I don't know that they're not a successor in title. Okay. Now, here's what I'm saying, Judge. We look at the overall context. If you're a lender and you go in and you see a phrase that says the owner, his heirs, devisees, personal representatives, and assigns, and the very next sentence you see that the obligation to pay, the personal obligation, passes. All of those four things that are listed in the prior sentence deal with situations where title passes. Where in the second sentence, the obligation, it says, passes. It also says, and Mr. Finkenbeiter, I think, misspoke because he said, it only says it passes. No, it says it remains with the owner and it passes, mm-hmm. Which you can't have. I mean...
The personal obligation to pay could. The
personal obligation...
to pay, and then anybody else who took it would also... No, if they read
if,
this,
if you assume
they
it,
that.
Yes. But I don't think you can keep it and pass it at the same time.
Well, it might not be able to collect from both people who owed the obligation.
Right, and that raises all kinds of questions about how you sue.
It looks like to me that they're trying to make it so that they can collect against as many people as possible. Right. I mean, that was their strategy. That's clearly what they intended to do.
Well, I'm not so sure, Judge, because if that were the intent, why didn't they have the lien attached to the property in the hands of as many people as possible? Because as the Southern District pointed out, the primary way that you go about collecting is you have your lien on the property and you force the issue by foreclosing the lien. But the developer, I guess, chose not to do that, chose to limit the number of people to whom the lien applies.
Well,
okay?
But why... one reason might be is they don't want to own the property. They just want paid their obligation. Right? They don't want to have to own the property.
Maybe
they own 20 of those already that they're not collecting fees on. If your client comes in and forecloses on it, they at least get the fees from your client. They don't own yet another that they're not receiving a personal obligation on.
I guess what I'm saying, Judge, is if you're looking at whose property they choose to foreclose on, if they don't want to own the property, that, to me, that's a different question than the number of people in whose hands the lien attaches to the property. They have specifically limited the number of people in whose hands the lien attaches. And then when you read these two sentences together, and in the second sentence you see pass in light of heirs and devisees and assigns, that's past type language. That's not general broad language. And then you read the sentence that I think maybe we disagree on how you read it, but I don't think that the personal obligation can both remain and pass. I just watched the Super Bowl, and the quarterback either held the football or he passed it.
If we look at an and I'm asking, is this an analogous situation, that I loan you money or you buy a car from me, and I finance you buying the car from me. And when I do that, I say, not only do I have a lien on the car, but anybody you sell the car is going to owe me personally any debt you have on the car. Whoever buys that car, are they obligated to pay me? Is that a similar circumstance?
I don't think so, because there's no privity of that contract between you and the buyer of the car.
Well, if it's part of the agreement to establish the lien, then can I claim that whoever you sell the car to owes me personally?
I don't think so.
And so is that the same circumstance that in buying, somehow they can obligate, by their agreement with the owner of the property, they can obligate a purchaser to owe them personally?
I think that gets into the question of what is the effect of the recording of the declaration and what kind of notice is given. And again, that brings us full circle to what does this all mean?
Well, you're not alleging the bank. You're alleging the bank is not bound by any of the restrictive covenants or any of the declaration, any of the POA provisions, or you're just alleging they don't owe the back assessment?
I'm saying we don't owe the back assessment. There's no question.
So if the declaration of restrictive covenants has certain requirements and obligations in it, once the bank succeeds to title, they are obligated to follow those covenants.
The bank wore two hats. The bank wore the lender hat, and unfortunately, because it had the bid in the property at the foreclosure sale,
I understand
sale, it
that,
the
but buyer. But I'm more basic point that, and the difference in that situation is here, it's an ongoing covenant with the land. So once the bank has the land, they have to comply with the covenants, and we're simply dealing with a question of interpretation of what those covenants require.
I think that's right. If I understand your question right, Judge Stith. Once the bank became the property owner, it paid the assessments that accrued under its ownership.
And it was obligated to do it. So the question is, was it also obligated as a property owner to pay prior assessments? And we're trying to interpret this phrase, the obligation of the owners to pay assessments shall remain the seller's personal obligation and shall pass to successors in title.
Right. That's the question. What is successors in title?
Why isn't successors in title a clear legal term that has a defined meaning? Why are we going into maxims of construction? If something's clear and unambiguous, it has a certain meaning and you give it that meaning.
Because to get there to say successors in title is unambiguous, you have to lift it out of the context in which it's written.
So you're saying every word's ambiguous, you have to look at the context of it.
You have to look at the whole agreement, and everybody in all the courts...
No word has a clear legal meaning.
Well, but you're suggesting you have to look at the lien sentence, or you're suggesting they couldn't carve out different obligations. I mean, I'm not sure.
Well, I think they might be able to carve it out, Judge, but okay. to do it... with language that is broad and ill-defined, okay, in light of an immediately preceding sentence that specifically talks in terms of parties who bear a personal relationship somehow through assignment or through inheritance with the defaulting owner.
For the lien.
Right. I can tell you, there is no lender in the world that is ever going to loan money on a condo if they think that once they make the loan, the owner doesn't pay his assessments and the bank has to step in and have personal liability for that. They're not going to make that loan. Their loans are going to get classified.
But the bank doesn't get personal liability for the past assessments by virtue of their lending. They get it by virtue of buying the property at the foreclosure sale.
I understand that. But, Judge, the only reason that they bought it at the foreclosure sale is because they had to.
Suppose Jane Doe had bought it at the foreclosure sale. Are you saying Jane Doe would not owe the past assessments?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
If Jane Doe had bought it on the courthouse steps instead of the bank, would Jane Doe owe these past assessments?
I don't think so.
Okay. Why isn't she a successor in title?
She is a successor in title, but I don't think in the term that means in this declaration based on the construction of that in the context of the
paragraph. Stay with me, though. If there had not been a foreclosure and Jane Doe had bought the property from the prior owner without the foreclosure in the intervening, would Jane Doe then owe the prior assessments?
I think so. And the reason
is... Why is it different that she bought it on the courthouse steps instead of through a realtor in the ordinary course?
Because as a voluntary buyer from the prior owner, she is an assignee. And that is specifically provided for in the prior sentence that deals also with the liens.
It deals just with the liens.
It deals with the liens. That's right. And
I understand why it's different for the lien, What I'm wondering is, why is it different for the next section in dealing with the entirely distinct concept?
Because if Jane Doe, Judge, had bought it at the foreclosure sale, she's not an assignee. And we briefed.
So she's not covered by the first section, but why isn't she covered by the second section?
She is covered because you have to read the second section in light of the first. Could I go back to these two out-of-state cases? Because
yeah.
There's an important distinction here. Okay, neither one of these cases had the disconnect between the lien clause and the personal obligation clause that we have in this case. And specifically, in the New York case, the lien clause said that the lien, quote, shall bind such lot in the hands of the then lot owner and such lot owner's heirs, devisees, personal representatives, successors, and assigns. And Mr. Finkenbinder told us that that's exactly what we have in our case. That is not. In that case, they specifically used the word successors, this broad term that then appears in the second sentence for the personal obligation. There is a disconnect in our case that is not present in that New York case. Neither one of those cases, and the same thing applies to the Florida case, because there was no limitation in that one. It didn't say a laundry list of including successors and assigns. There was just no limitation on anybody in whose hands the lien would apply. And so there's no disconnect there. Those two cases do not stand for the proposition that in this case, and I think this goes back to the question also that Judge Fisher asked, that in this case the term successors in title means something anybody and everybody in the world in light of this limitation. Again, I think if you are a lender particularly, because you want to make sure you get your money back, and you go, you read this, and you see language in the lien clause that puts the lien on the property only in the hands of people who've had some personal dealings with the defaulting property owner.
Mr. Schnocking, excuse me, so who would be a successor in title?
I think anybody who buys it, as Judge Wilson said, if Jane Doe comes in and she buys this property, she is a successor in title because if she bought it from the owner. I think if she buys it at foreclosure, she's not, because successors in title is not broad enough in this context.
Who's she buying it from at the sale?
She is buying from a trustee who executes the deed.
And
wrestles the property away from this property owner. The property owner isn't voluntarily conveying it at a foreclosure.
I understand, but she ends up as a title holder, mm-hmm. Jane Doe does, and the tenants, or the first purchasers, were title holders. Whether there's zero people in between or 10 people in between, why is it?
Because in one context, the conveyance is voluntary by the owner. Maybe it's voluntary through death because it goes through inheritance as well.
I understand that.
In the other context, it is not voluntary. It's an involuntary.
Not all successors and titles are assignees. I get that. But why isn't it a larger group than just assignees?
Because the question that we're dealing with, I think, is notice. When you look at these recorded covenants, what notice do they impart to a buyer at a foreclosure sale that you're going to have to go in and pay the defaulting owner's obligation to pay these fees?
How about the notice that it said successors entitled will have to pay them? Why isn't it notice that it says successors entitled will have to pay?
Because, again, I don't think you can lift that sentence and those three words out of the context of the whole sentence.
Tell me how you'd more clearly say it then.
I would say that if they want to say successors entitled on everything, you also put that word successor in the lien clause, just like the New York case did. Okay? If you want to make it clearer.
And what cases do you cite that the lien clause and the personal obligation clause must be identical or must refer to the same parties?
I don't say they have to be identical, Judge, but in context, they give each other support in how you interpret them and read them. And this court has said, and if I'm running into my rebuttal, I've still got a minute 48.
You're over time, but you can answer the question.
Okay. If I can give you a case citation or two.
Please.
If you don't mind.
Or if they're in your brief, or are they additional?
They're not in the brief. They're additional cases. This court looked at clauses in a deed in a case called Dooley versus Greening. By the way, I'll be glad to write the clerk a letter and
give
you
the
citation.
If you would, and send to your opposing counsel.
100 Southwest 43. It applied it to clauses in a will construction case, or the Court of Appeals did, in the Eastern District, in Breckner versus Prestwood, cases 600 Southwest 2nd 52, and the doctrine that I mentioned earlier of nascitur ars socius, which basically says you give a word the meaning of its, what its neighbors have to say, the words that surround it. This court has said that that applies to phrases as well as words. Excuse me, my page is stuck together here. All the way back to 1854, a case called Harper's Administrator versus Phoenix Insurance Company, 19 Mo 506, and as late as, and actually later, but a case in 1964 from this court in Bank, Foremost Dairies versus Thomason, 384 Southwest 2nd 651, says that that rule applies to related clauses as well as words. So I think you have to look at the whole context again, and my time is up, and so I would ask you to affirm.
Thank you.
Unless you have more questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, a couple of things. One of the things that the respondent alluded to was is that their owners tried to make some sort of distinction in answering the questions, made a distinction between their type of ownership and somebody else's based on this concept that theirs was not voluntary ownership. That is a red herring, because it is voluntary. And as this court already alluded to, the foreclosure itself is not a required thing. The bank is not put in the position where it has to foreclose like the respondent would have you believe. I represent lenders as well. There are many times where they look at the collateral and they say, no, we don't want the collateral. We'll just sue on the personal obligation under the note. So that's a red herring. And I think that the respondent was able to get the Southern District to catch on to that. Because in the Southern District's opinion, it made that type of analogy. It stated that, well, we're gonna make a distinction between whether or not a successor in title had a relationship with the, quote, original owner. And that was a new phrase used by the Southern District for the first time, even though you don't see original owner used anywhere in our declaration. And so I think that that is an issue or a concept that was artfully drafted by the respondent, but it's not relevant for this case. And Justice Breckinridge asked the previous hypothetical about the car situation and whether or not the lien would attach and use that analogy. And there is a circumstance in Missouri where, as this court knows, that does occur. And for example, I know it's a different situation, but in sales tax, if you sell a business, if you sell a portion, substantially all or all of your assets in a business, the Missouri Department of Revenue gets to say there's joint and several liability. Not only does that personal liability to pay the sales tax stay with the person who incurred it, it goes with the asset. It doesn't necessarily just attach to the lien. The new buyer of that company or its assets is personally obligated to pay the sales tax to the Department of Revenue. And that is a creature of the legislature. But nevertheless, it's been held to be constitutional, and it's been upheld in this court, that concept. So while maybe I would have used different words if I were drafting the phrase or on the personal obligation when it says, it shall remain and pass. I would have used successor in title had I drafted this. But had I drafted it, maybe I would have used the word joint and several liability instead of remain and pass. But I think that we can look at it as a layman would look at it, certainly, and a decently somewhat intelligent attorney would look at it and say, well, that means joint and several liability. Maybe it was not the best artful language, but that was its intent, and we can pick that up from the use of successors in title. And with that, I'll finish. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Case will be submitted.